again to everybody out there in Greater Turdville. It is Thursday. You know what that means. It is time for Access to Access, your weekly interactive webinar that gives you the chance to interact and speak with, pose questions directly to the guest. That's why we use the GoToWebinar platform. Today's guest is a returning favorite, good friend of Turdville, one of the smartest guys I know, and really hardly any better person that we could find to discuss 2017 in general. And that's Alistair McLeod. Alistair is the head of research for Gold Money. You can find his writings at goldmoney.com, but you can also find his writings on his own site. Alistair, what's it called again?
It's financeandeconomics.org.
All right, Alistair is here, and he's here to discuss 2017 with us. Again, as many here have heard me say, 2017 is, at least in my idea, going to be a wildly unpredictable year. And ever since the election of Donald Trump, there has been this what we call generally accepted narrative that has been forced down our throats in the financial media and from all the sell side analysts that, oh, this is easy. There's going to be this big infrastructure program and Trump's going to cut taxes and the debt's going to go up, but that's okay because the dollar is going to soar and interest rates are going to go up and the stock market's going to 25,000 and this is easy. And so far, Alistair, it's not really playing out that way here in 2017. So I just want to get your thoughts on the generally accepted narrative and your thoughts in general on the macro environment. What do you say?
Well, I think it's going to be a bit different from the way you put it. And there is one thing which we need to watch, and that is where money flows within the economy. I just take a step back and say where I think we are in the economic cycle. It has been noticeable since the beginning of 2016 that bank lending has been expanding in the United States. Now, what this tells me is that the economy is expanding as well, and we're out of recession, and therefore, the economy is actually in a pretty healthy place. So we now have a situation where, with Donald Trump being elected, he now, on top of that, wants to spend some money on infrastructure, or at least get people to spend money on infrastructure. He's also talking about, as you say, cutting taxes, which basically means the fiscal deficit will increase, as again you said. And on top of that, he's getting major corporations, instead of investing in factories abroad, they're going to invest in the US. All this is wonderful. But it has one effect, and that is it takes money out of the financial sector and moves it into the non-financial sector. Now, the money coming out of the financial sector, and this is the important point to understand, forget valuations or anything like that, but when money starts going out of the financial sector, asset prices start deflating. And instead of asset inflation continuing to go, as it were, you find that the deflation is offset to a degree by an increase in inflation in the non-financial sector. So basically, putting it another way, the money moves from Wall Street into Main Street, and when it comes out of Wall Street, there's less to invest. Now, what this means is that the first type of asset that goes down in value is, believe it or not, bonds, and we've already seen the start of that. The next shoe to drop will be equities. So what I'm saying is that equities are close to the top. They cannot really go any further. And then the next shoe to drop after that will be property prices. That is the order of events when you get the cycle starts running into capacity constraints because money has been moving out of Wall Street into Main Street. And I think that's the thing that your listeners have really got to look at and examine and feel and not be tempted by brokers who will tell you that, now that Donald Trump's doing this, it means that money is going to go into pharmaceuticals or it's going to go into motor manufacturing and these P's are going to drop even further than we thought yesterday and therefore you've got to buy these stocks. No, the thing that determines the level of asset prices is the way money actually flows in the economy. If it's flowing into assets, then asset prices go up. If it's flowing out of assets, they go down. So what I'm saying is that the economy in the United States is going to pick up, if you like, on top of the expansion of bank lending that we saw through 2016. That is marking more or less the top of the market. You'll find that the economy is looking quite good in 2017, barring any accidents from places like Europe. But in the process, you'll find that asset prices will be declining. So I'm very cautious on that front.
What, Alistair, if we get kind of a repeat of 2016 or August of 2015, where instead of a kind of a gradual top in the market, because I'm with you on that one, we get rather sharply falling market like we're seeing here on Thursday morning. And what if that leads to instead a safe haven bid for bonds and lower interest rates? Does that kind of change the dynamic, the geometry a little bit?
Well, I can certainly see the equity market having cracks in it. I can't see money going into bonds on a safe haven basis. Because we're looking at a market which I think, as I say, you've got the money which is now going out of financials into non-financials. And that basically means that bonds go down as well. And if anything, bond yields are likely to rise quite considerably over a period of the next 12 months. This brings me on to another subject which I think actually could interrupt the whole thing and bring about something close to what you're suggesting. And that is that falling bond prices plus the bad debt situation in Europe could undermine the Eurozone banks. Mm-hmm. The Eurozone banks are very, very highly geared. They've got very little equity for the amount of debt they're carrying on their balance sheets. A lot of their investments are in sovereign debt, sovereign bonds which yield virtually nothing. When a sovereign bond yields virtually nothing, then you know there's only one way, more or less, for that sovereign bond price to go, and that's down. Now, if these sovereign bond prices fall by something like 5%, there are going to be a whole raft of banks in the Eurozone getting into trouble. And that sort of problem, with the potential for political disintegration in Europe, you can suddenly see that it doesn't matter what the Donald does, it could well be that the big story is the collapsing, imploding Eurozone. I think that's a real risk this year, by the way.
So then that was the second thing I wanted to ask you about, and that's the dollar. I mean, we're already seeing, just as we did last year at this time, tremendous stress. I mean, the last time you and I spoke, we talked about the euro dollars and the LIBOR, and how LIBOR was reaching multi-year highs and how that's impacting the dollar. So anyway, the dollar has rallied like crazy over the last 60 days, but it appears to be rolling over. But it, you know, as you talk about the euro and struggles in the euro and even the European Union as a whole, that's a big part of the dollar index. I mean, if the dollar continues to go up, what kind of extra stress does that provide? Not only, like I said, here in the US and exports, but to the emerging markets and to dollar liquidity and dollar funding and dollar shortages worldwide.
Yeah, you're absolutely right to bring that subject up. But there are two aspects of dollar valuation. There's the dollar valuation against paper currencies, which is the one that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And there is also the dollar valuation against commodities, which is a rather different thing. Now, commodity prices through 2016 rose quite significantly. I noticed, for example, that something like iron ore went up nearly 100%.
Right.
Copper was up, I think, something like 17, 18, 19% on the year. Various other base metals such as nickel also performed similarly and maybe went a bit higher than that. I think that the point about commodities is that they are actually developing rather a life on their own. There has been, I think, over the last 4 or 5 years, a reduction in overall productive capacity of various key commodities. And the result of that is that China, which requires these commodities for its own economy and also for the development of Asia, which is really where her external focus is now, she is stockpiling commodities to a very large degree. And she's more or less is cornering the copper market, for example. I know that she's been buying more iron ore because the stockpiles that she had have turned out to be useless. I think that there's been oxidation, and so the result is that they've almost got to sort of scrap it and start again. So China is continuing to buy these commodities, as well as energy, incidentally. And now we have a situation where Donald Trump wants to start rebuilding America's infrastructure. And so, you know, American corporations on his behalf are going to go out and try and pick up these commodities. So what I can see is that there is, if you like, a clash between China and America in terms of increasing investment in infrastructure, which is going to continue to have a very powerful effect on commodity prices. That being the case, inflation is likely to rise considerably more in America than most people realize. But at the same time, if you look at what the currency buys in paper currencies, you're absolutely right to point out that with the euro looking like it could well be getting itself into a terminal situation, the dollar's trade weighted is likely to increase quite substantially. So I think you've got to look at these two separate things. You've got the commodity prices, which I believe are going to, if you like, give a spin of price inflation into everyday life, and you have got the currency effect, which is likely to look like it's going the other way. What this means for the poor people in the Eurozone is that their inflation is going to pick up quite substantially compared to anything anyone thinks. I mean, if you've got a problem in America, I think that in Europe, they're likely to have an even greater problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Going to be an interesting year, Alistair, no doubt about that. And we're just going to have to see how it all, you know, it's almost a chaos theory type thing. You don't know if some unforeseen event will happen and that will affect something else, which will affect something else. And that's, I guess, at the end of the day, why I think it's going to be such a wildly unpredictable year.
Yes, I think I'd agree with that. It's that you've got all these variables. It's a bit like a juggling act trying to work out which of these balls is going to come down first.
Yeah. Well, but actually, that's all part of the fun of what you do, I'm sure, and why I've always had such a keen interest in this macro stuff, because it's like a big, massive puzzle. You know, and you try to figure it out and try to make a forecast based off all these different variables. And it's remarkably hard to do, challenging, but that's all part of what makes it fun.
Yes, I'd agree. I do agree.
All right, my friend, I've got a couple questions stacking up in queue. But first of all, I had someone post a question to the site. And so I'm going to start with that. And for anybody that is listening, if you want to ask a question of Alistair, on your GoToWebinar control panel, there is a questions tab. You click it, the dialog box will open. You type into that dialog box, and it comes to me here on my MacBook, and I relay it to Alistair. And we got a couple of them already in queue, but the one that appeared on the site this morning comes from a regular user of KFMR, who just, as we look at deflation, inflation, central bank methods to try to spark inflation, which is what they obviously want to always do to keep growing the debt and funding the debt. This question was, why, in your opinion, has the Bank of Japan been unable now for, 28 years unable to create any sustained inflation at all? I mean, they've tried. I mean, you talk about throwing the kitchen sink at it. They've thrown the whole kitchen. Why have they been unsuccessful, Alistair? Is it a demographic thing? What are your thoughts?
No, it's not a demographic thing. I mean, you can quote all sorts of reasons, but basically people who do are sort of making up reasons for something they don't really or can't otherwise explain. I think the way I would sum it up is to say that the performance of the Japanese yen is the greatest example of subjectivity of prices. In other words, the price of the yen in terms of its purchasing power and also against other currencies is effectively determined by the opinions of people who reckon that it's a stable currency, rather than, if you like, an in-depth examination of the fundamentals behind the currency. I mean, we all know this. You can get a long, long time of price stability, basically because nobody thinks that prices are going to go up. As soon as they think that prices go up, then the thing becomes self-feeding. There is the risk that that will eventually happen to the yen, but we see very little sign of it at the moment. We have seen the yen go down against the dollar recently, but this has absolutely had no effect internally in Japan at all. There is another thing I would say, and that is that the Japanese government continue to tell us that, you know, they've got to try and rescue the economy, they've got to do this, got to do that, and they've certainly increased the level of government debt level relative to GDP to the highest in the world. But if you look at the underlying economy, it's actually not all that bad. I mean, everybody's been bad-mouthing the economy because there's no growth and there's no inflation and all the rest of it. Well, put the inflation thing to one side. The fact of the matter is, the way the Japanese economy works is you've got these very big zaibatsus, or conglomerate corporations, who have operations all around the world. I mean, they've got the most efficient car plant in Europe is in the north of England here. They own other car plants around Europe. They own manufacturing businesses in China, which, you know, they're meant to be from time to time almost at war with. The fact is that the big zaibatsus actually do very, very well, and they reflect the, if you like, the overall business climate around the world, and are very good at exploiting it. So what they do, basically, is they don't manufacture much in Japan anymore, but what they do is they remit their profits from their overseas operations back to Japan. So that the Japanese economy is perhaps best compared with Switzerland rather than you know, a normal manufacturing economy such as Germany or such as Britain or such as, I don't know, any of the other sort of major mature economies. So I think the only thing I can say about coming back to the question about the exchange rate is that the exchange rate, basically, everybody believes that the yen is stable. Therefore, it is stable. It's as simple as that, really.
Yeah. Well, what can they do if they want to spark inflation after 30 years? I mean, what more can they do? Is there anything left? I mean, helicopter money where they just directly start monetizing everything? Well, not that they're already not directly monetizing everything, but I guess formally announce that they're going to just, you know, give away money or just monetize all their debt or whatever. What else can they do?
Well, you see, I mean, it's rather like the American problem in the sense that the money that is created basically remains in the, if you like, in the financial system. It doesn't go out to Main Street. Why doesn't it go out to Main Street? Because Main Street actually is manufacturing abroad. It's not manufacturing in Japan.
Right.
And so they have this extraordinary situation where they can print almost as much as they like, and it has very little effect on the prices at the high street level.
Kind of like the U.S. with our exorbitant privilege.
Yes, if you like. I mean, I think this idea that you need to have rising prices to stimulate demand is a load of hogwash. Right. I just don't go with it at all. And there is absolutely no evidence that that is actually the case. But, you know, the macroeconomic community believe that that is so. So they inflict us with inflation
right.
in the name of trying to stimulate us into spending something. It is really a load of rubbish.
And the damn bankers, that's what they want. You know, that's what they want. They want more money so they can charge more interest on it. I mean, at the end of the day, that's how they came out that story.
They either charge more interest or more likely what they do is they gear up their balance sheets.
There you go. That's right, too. Okay, my friend, I've got a handful of questions. Everybody has something they want to get from you, Alistair, so I better dive right in because we're already 20 minutes into this. The first question is kind of shared by two folks. Info, a guy by the name goes by name Info, and a guy by name goes by the name of Larry. By the name of Larry and the name of Info. Info's mother must have really had a good sense of humor. Anyway, they both want to know about this potential arbitrage opportunity in Shanghai. Info's question is anyone taking advantage of the silver arbitrage between London and Shanghai, which we know is been greater than 10% at times in the last few weeks. And Larry's question is, why are Shanghai prices higher, lower? He says, why are Shanghai gold prices lower than COMEX? I don't know if that's today or what the story is. But anyway, you've got this potential arbitrage there that doesn't seem to be happening with that spread of $1.50 or more in silver between London and Shanghai. And I just add one more thought. Maybe it is happening. Maybe that spread is only $1.50 because it's happening. I don't know. What are your thoughts on this, Alistair?
I don't know. I wasn't aware there was that spread between the two. I mean, one of the things we certainly have seen with backwardations in the gold market, which shouldn't actually happen,
right,
is that a backwardation in the gold market tends to occur when you don't trust counterparties. In other words, you'd rather hold on to the real stuff than lend it out. And that means that, you know, the counterparties or potential counterparties have got to bid up for it. There may be a bit of that going on. But also, I don't think there is very much real connection between the players in Shanghai and, say, in the London bullion market. Mm. So, consequently, you will get differentials from time to time which aren't closed by arbitrage when you think they should be closed by arbitrage. It's a bit of a lame answer, but I'm sorry, Messrs. Info and Larry, I don't think I can say much more than that.
All right, then let's move on to – hold on. I thought that was – maybe I – oh, shoot. I asked Info's second question and then deleted his first one. So, Info, if you could type back in your first one, let me move on to the next question on the list. Maybe Info can type in, retype his first one. Man, I'm having a tough day, Alistair, for crying out loud.
Okay.
We all have them, I suppose. All right. Simon wants to know, does Alistair have any update or concerns relating to China's and Mexico's current financial state? Again, a lot of this has to do with their currency as an emerging market. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, Mexico I don't follow that much. China is an interesting one because if you look at it from where you're sitting in the dollar, you see the yuan going down and you think, capital outflows and all the rest of it. I'm sure there are some capital outflows, but actually if you look at the Chinese currency against a basket of currencies, against, say, the yen, which is one of their major trading partners, and also the euro, another major trading partner. And actually, the yuan doesn't look too bad against them. It's just really against the dollar. So when you read commentary out of the United States, it tends, I think, to overemphasize the weakness of the yuan. There's no doubt that China tries to manage the currency as much as possible. I mean, they manage virtually everything they can. I think these problems, you know, they intensify from time to time and then they go away. I don't really see any big problems in China. I know that China has a lot of bad debt, but then the Chinese government owns the banks. So what's the problem, basically? You know, the government writes off some money. It doesn't matter because there's lots more money where that came from. You know, it's a very different situation from the sort of normal economy which we're used to being involved with and commenting on. So I wouldn't worry too much about China. Okay. Mexico, you know, I see there's been a certain amount of currency volatility, which I think is almost Trump-inspired as much as anything.
Yeah.
There's more volatility in something like the Turkish lira, which is not looking at all good, by the way.
So, yeah, again, another emerging market that is flaring up.
Yeah, it's Turkey is not just an emerging market, it's actually quite central to the Middle East. I mean, we know its proximity to Syria. Also, it's the route for gold trading right into the various stans to the north of Tibet. It really does. It connects the Muslim world with a lot of gold. And the weakness in the Turkish lira has been going on for an awful long time, about 30, 40 years. I mean, they're not six noughts off it. I think it was in 2004. Can you imagine losing six noughts off your currency? And it's still going down. The result of all this is that, of course, the Turks actually think gold is money rather than the paper stuff the government dishes out.
Yeah.
I think that's going to be very much an increasing situation, not just in Turkey, but in various other countries. And I would suspect that there might be a bit of that developing in Mexico as well. But Mexico does have the advantage with you just across the border. They really sort of rely on the dollar a lot more as a hedge out of their own domestic currency.
Yeah. All right. Let Euro Buddha know that I'm going to take his question and substitute it for one of mine in the final four. Moving from there, let's get to, I guess this is Cohen's question. Will Trump start a trade war with China, and will China then reduce exports of rare earth metals like what happened between China and Japan in 2010?
I think that's an extremely good question. now that really is a very, very good question. Trump, I think, is making an extent. I mean, it seems to me that his economics is completely wrong. He thinks that trade deficits are the result of other countries undercutting domestic producers. The fact of the matter is that if you go and buy something from abroad, then what you have to have is you've got to have the money to pay for it. And if you've got the money to pay for it, fine. If you haven't, then you can't buy something from abroad. And this is why you tend to get a budget deficit at the same time as a trade deficit, because the government, if you like, is creating the money one way or the other through overspending in order to finance purchases from abroad. The expansion of bank credit does exactly the same thing. So I think Trump is actually, I can't see that's a point that he actually understands. So that is a big flaw in his approach. Now, having said that, he's a businessman. He's taking a completely different approach when it comes to trade compared with anyone in the past. He's obviously given up on the idea that, if you like, government bureaucrats can actually negotiate the top off the top off a rice pudding. I mean, and he's right. I mean, when you think of TTIP, I mean, here we are, God knows how many years afterwards, and they got absolutely nowhere with it, and it will be abandoned now. So Trump actually knows what he's doing, I think, when it comes to negotiating business deals. And that does apply to a situation where he's going to go and talk to China. And I think what he's been doing so far is he's been maneuvering himself into a negotiating position so that he can work from a position of strength, and he's got things which he can then give up. And the Chinese, I think, to an extent, are doing the same in a minor way. They're trying to read him, if you like. And I think what it does mean is that they will come to a deal. The other side of this is that China's focus, in any event, is moving away from selling cheap goods around the world, and obviously particularly to America. Her focus is moving back into two things. Firstly, she wants services and technology for her expanding middle class, and she's going to add about 200 million people to her middle class by the end of 2018. Now, that's a staggering thought.
Yeah.
Another thing that she's doing is she is investing in infrastructure throughout Asia. She's bringing an industrial revolution to the wider Asian continent, which is going to absorb an awful lot of money and also an awful lot of Chinese expertise. It's going to provide employment and all the rest of it. And it's going to give her her long-term markets. That's what she wants. So in a sense, what Donald Trump is complaining about, you know, China and all the rest of it, you know, on the one hand is economically illiterate, but also China are moving in a different direction anyway. So in a sense, we're really sort of trying to make something out of yesterday's story.
All right. So to that end, as you mentioned China, I've got two questions pending here from Will. And rather than try to paraphrase them, I'm just going to take a second, if you'll bear with me, and read them to you and then just get your response, okay?
Okay.
Will says, I have read a lot of recent commentary revolving around the notion that the wealth disparity and corruption in China exceeds that seen almost anywhere else in the world. Given the populist movements in the West that have been fueled by these kinds of issues, and given the long tradition of revolution in China, how do you view the possibility of a populist uprising occurring, and I'll add the word again, in China, especially if their huge shadow banking system collapses, And then to that end, I'm going to move forward then to his next question. He then says, I've noted the fact that you and Kyle Bass have rather divergent views regarding the economic outlook for China. What do you consider to be China's redeeming advantages in the face of what might certainly be a looming credit, currency, and liquidity crisis in their future?
Right, okay. Let me start with the first one about the wealth disparity and corruption.
Yeah.
President Xi has actually been addressing this one quite aggressively since he came into office. And I think that that problem is a lesser problem than it was, say, 2 or 3 years ago, and I would expect President Xi to continue to try and deal with that, you know, with the corruption problem. So I think that, in a sense, I hope anyway, it will, that's yesterday's story. I mean, yes, there is a wealth disparity, but, you know, isn't there one in America? I mean, wealth disparities actually arise from printing money more than anything else. I think in the case of China, that's certainly true. But I think also in the case of China, there are some people who have genuinely provided things for the economy, which has improved everybody's lives. Now, I don't think we feel bad about someone becoming very rich on the back of that sort of thing. So, I mean, you know, someone like Bill Gates, you know, he produced a Microsoft software system, which actually, you know, the whole world uses. We've got a man over here called James Dyson who invented the bagless Hoover, or not Hoover, the vacuum cleaner. And again, he's made, I suppose, several hundred million. We don't, you know, that sort of person, we're actually quite happy that he makes money because he's provided something that is useful for you and me and our friends. What we don't like are people like bankers who go out and print money, which is a fraud on the rest of us, and make a lot of money. That's the bit that we don't like. China, I'm sure, has got exactly the same situation. You've got people who've made money through fraud, overt or covert, and you've also got people who have genuinely earned it. So I don't think that's a problem which is much different from the one we've got.
Okay.
In respect of Kyle Bass, I know has been very down on China. You know, I can understand his argument. You know, there's a huge great credit bubble and all the rest of it. But where I think he's wrong was in two things. Firstly, the government owns the banks, which basically means that the banks don't go bust, which is a very different thing from a credit bubble somewhere else. And the second thing is that it's a command economy still. It's you know, the Chinese government act like a good old-fashioned mercantilist system, and that is they run the country as if it was a huge great corporation for the benefit of the people at the top. And so long as the people throughout the economy actually broadly have the same benefits, obviously to a lesser extent, the same sense of political direction, you can continue to do that for a long period of time without the requirement of having real democracy. That's what they're doing. And so far, they've been doing it really quite successfully. And this is the big difference between a Western democracy and China. China can plan 5 years ahead, and she's got these rolling, you know, five-year plans. But when she does a five-year plan, she also looks forward to the next 5 years and the 5 years after that. They are long-term strategic thinkers. And this is something that our politicians just cannot do. We've got, when we look at China, we've got to adjust, if you like, our sights for that big, big difference. And I think that's really where Kyle Bass and I probably differ.
Yeah. All right. Next question. You'll like this gentleman's name. His name is Lost Mind. I know a little
Lost Mind.
I lost mine years ago. That's just from following gold and silver.
Join the club. Yeah, join the club.
Lost Mind has a question. Actually, two. And again, I'm just going to read these off to you and let you run with it. Hi, Alistair. With the potential for the U.S. dollar losing its total reserve currency down to a 48% share of the SDR, do you think this is the purpose of the SDR to reduce reliance upon the U.S. dollar as reserve currency? And what will be the next stage of a world currency? And how will it impact the U.S. economy and the world economy overall?
Right, okay. Well, the original purpose of the SDR, I think, was actually to ensure that the dollar remained as the reserve currency. The way I would look at it is that the other currencies that have been included are almost sort of by blows to the whole thing to give the SDR respectability.
Yeah.
But there is no doubt in my mind that the Americans looked at the SDR as something that they should have control over. Now that has been eroded a bit, obviously, with the yuan coming in from, was it, I think, last October. Some people say that the SDR is the currency, the big currency of the future. I don't see that. The way I look at the SDR is it's merely something that is comprised of the underlying currencies. It's not a currency on its own. And it's only as good as those underlying currencies. So the idea that the SDR can replace ordinary currencies, I don't think is correct. I just can't see how that's possible. I don't think the SDR has much effect on the US economy. I think probably what matters as much as anything is in the future, if you get large currency swaps, large lines of currency swaps, which are quite likely, given that you've got the problems in the Eurozone. I mean, I think the Eurozone banks are likely to require dollars, I think, in the future. So swap arrangements between the Fed and the ECB are likely to be set up. Now, that could have an effect eventually on the dollar because, dollars are produced for those banks, and if they sell them in return for other assets such as euro-denominated assets, then obviously it's going to create a potential source of supply of dollars in the foreign exchanges. But you know, that sort of thing I think is pretty unpredictable in the future. So I think it would be a mistake to think of the SDR as really having any effect, if you like, at our level.
Okay. All right. Well, Alistair, you've been very generous with your time, and I know everybody listening very much appreciates that. To that end, I've still got three questions in queue. Less, who knows how many more will come in, so I better keep moving right along. Sanford has a question about gold money. He said he recently became a gold money customer. With all the talk of possible economic collapse, has gold money put any plans in place for operation on the other side should this happen? Will customer access be limited just to physical redemption?
That's a good question. I'm not quite sure how to answer that. I mean, if the world comes to a halt, will we still be standing?
Not just a golden.
I think I have to slightly pass on that.
Yeah.
I mean, what I can tell you is that we do have a certain amount of inventory, if you like, as well. So, you know, that if you like is the company's property, and I would have thought that if shortages of gold develop in the market, then we should be all right for a bit. I would just actually make the point that the market for gold is actually about 160,000, 170,000 tons of gold. I just don't think that there's going to be any sort of permanent shortage of gold. What you could get is a temporary shortage if the price is wrong.
Yeah, right.
But basically what happens under those circumstances is that the price rises to the point where gold is supplied.
Right.
So apart from the odd little problem, which, you know, through mispricing and all the rest of it, we know markets aren't efficient. I mean, anyone who tells you markets are efficient or assumes they are is talking absolute rubbish. It is quite possible that you get the sort of situation where gold is so mispriced that there is no supply at a particular level. And you do see, you know, if you buy gold in the market sometimes, you can't get delivery for a week or two. It doesn't often happen, but sometimes it happens. I would think that under normal circumstances, I'd say we've probably got enough inventory to cover that sort of problem.
And everything.
I can't really say, you know, I'd love to be able to say that you know, when the world falls apart, we're still standing. But I think that would be slightly dishonest of me because I don't know the answer to that one.
Yeah. And everything, and just to assure everybody, everything at Gold Money is fully allocated. All the gold is all there. It's not.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's not our property, it's your property.
Right.
And congratulations for opening an account, Sanford.
All right.
We welcome you to the phone.
Next question comes from Boing Snap. Don't you love some of these names, Alistair?
Can you repeat that one? I missed it.
We just call him Boing, like boy oy oing.
Boing.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Boing wants to know. You know, I've had Andrew McGuire and Tom Coughlin on before, and we've talked about their new exchange. It's called Allocated Bullion Exchange, and you know, it's a physical exchange. And in the end, whether it's ABX or something else, we've got to get these producers of the metal to stop dealing with the bullion banks and with their derivative pricing scheme. Boeing's question is basically, will producers, or what's it going to take to get producers to stop dealing with the LBMA, stop dealing with the banks that offer them the financing, and work with a different exchange altogether, be it Shanghai or ABX or something else?
The problem is that a producer has, he's got a business to run, and his business happens to be extracting something called gold. He's got all his costs to pay. He's got to pay his miners and all the rest of it. And the risk he faces is that the price of gold might go down to below where it was, when the miners took it out. So you can see that if you're running a business as opposed to just being a bull of gold with a gold mine, which and you've got enough fiat money to pay everything off and you don't actually care, you just want to stockpile the gold, I mean, fine, that's what you do. That's actually what the Chinese government are doing, by the way. But the reality is that these mines in the West are all businesses, and they have got to produce profits out of what they're doing. And in order to secure some sort of steadiness in that in those profits, they have to hedge things in the market from time to time. That's the business decision they take. So I don't think, Sam, that it's Boeing, this one, isn't it?
That's right.
I don't think Boeing we're going to, I think the idea that, mines can sort of pick and choose who they deal with is, I wish it were the case, but I'm afraid it's not. It's not really realistic. Gold will go up. More correctly, what I will say is not so much gold going up, but paper currencies will go down,
yeah.
And they will continue to go down. I mean, if you look at what's happened to the price of the dollar, let's just look at things from a gold perspective. The price of the dollar from about 1935 has actually fallen to roughly 2% of its starting point. So it's lost 98% of its value since 1935, measured in gold.
Yeah.
And that's a trend I don't see changing.
Right. The follow-up question from Lost Mind was, on a macro sense, is it better to have your economy have the reserve currency and thus run continual deficits as the U.S., or is it better to not be the reserve currency and just kind of do your thing?
The reserve currency, I mean, basically, the reserve currency, the dollar is the reserve currency because that's the way it was set up post-World War II. And pretty well all international business still runs itself in dollars. So, if you're a British company and you're doing things abroad, you don't necessarily finance the things abroad in sterling. You would probably use the dollar. So it's actually quite hard to break that habit. One of the things that will break the habit, I think, is that if more and more of the world trade is actually settled in other currencies, then you'll find those other currencies will be used more and more for not only trade but also financing. But I think that the way I would see the dollar moving up against the euro in the next 2 to 3 years, it would suggest to me that the dollar is still going to be really pretty important around the world, whatever the Chinese say. The Chinese will do their own thing. They don't want to get involved with the dollar. And I don't think a nice meeting between President Xi and Mr. Trump is actually going to change that.
Yeah.
So I'm afraid that, you know, the dollar is the reserve currency, and the reality is that if you're in business, that's what you're going to work with.
Yeah, yeah. All right, one last question, and it's a follow-up from Cohen. And I think this is an interesting one. I think you'll like it. He said, when, I like the when part, when the price of gold rises substantially, let's say $3,000, $4,000 an ounce, will there be any countries in the world that will not nationalize their gold mines or put on windfall profit taxes of the mines?
Well, I like the when. I think there's a degree of certainty in there which I would agree with. I really can't answer that. It is quite likely that countries will home in on gold if very substantial numbers of people are deemed to be speculating in it. I think that's the key, because politics works on the basis of envy. If you're a politician, the problem you get is from someone whinging that someone else is making money at their expense. And if gold is ever seen to be like that, then I think we watch out. I think that there could be a special tax introduced in some countries. That's the way they would do it, I think, rather than outright confiscation. I mean, you can tax gold as much as you want.
Right.
Things are not going that way at the moment, admittedly. And also, the other thing that I think any government would have to bear in mind is what is likely to be the effect on the price of introducing such a tax. What it would do is it would basically stop people selling. So it could actually exacerbate a rising price problem.
Yeah, that's good.
Instead of, if you'd like, trying to discourage future buyers. So they'd have to be very, very careful with that. But it's, I think, to raise special taxes on gold so that you can't keep any of your profits or all the rest of it. I mean, that sort of thing, I think, is riddled with unexpected consequences.
Yep. Alistair, one last question I see before we get to the wrap up and the final four. It has to do with this notion of Sharia compliant gold that the World Gold Council worked on last year and finally pushed through. And is this, I guess I'll just paraphrase the question, is this going to be good for the price of gold, or is it just simply another, are they just going to cook up another scheme like the GLD and try to shove all that new demand into an ETF and try to shelter it?
I think it will be good for gold, but what we're talking about is the 1.7 billion people who are of the Muslim faith, and they're particularly across, obviously, the Middle East, North Africa, and also into Southeast Asia. I mean, countries like Indonesia, they have got 220 million Muslims. These aren't all, Muslims have a very bad press at the moment, but I can assure you that the ordinary people in that, the ordinary Muslims in that part of the world are actually sort of quite peaceful people who are just getting on with their lives and so on.
Yep.
I think the point about various gold investments and products becoming Sharia compliant is that it opens up the market very substantially, not just for Muslims, who would only insist in holding investments in accordance with Sharia law, but it makes gold investments so much more acceptable, even to what I would call the more marginal Muslims. So, yes, I think this is going to develop actually quite a lot of demand, and I think it's also a very good utility, because these people face restrictions on the use of cash in the future. And what I would hope is that gold becomes used more and more as a means of settling business transactions in the Muslim world. And I think that, so to my mind, this is actually a very, very good thing.
Fair enough. Well, all right, my friend, that was a very informative 50 minutes. Can you believe how time flies when you're having fun, Alistair?
I know. My glass is empty. I got to go and do something about it, I think, Craig.
Those ice cubes are getting lonely in that glass. They need something in there with them. Alistair, The fun is just starting, though. We've got to wrap up with the final four, which is always about the most fun part of the show. If you're ready, can I lay them on you?
I'm ready, yep.
Okay, you know the rules. It's just kind of some, you know, a sentence or even just one word for an answer. But you can go on as long as you want. Question number one, will Donald Trump serve all 4 years of his term?
They're talking about him impeaching him before he's even bloody president. How do I?
They just quit. They just say, "The hell with it."
You know, I tell you what I think. And this is just totally off the wall. I think he might turn out to be a very successful president. I think he's the sort of president you might look back on, and you know, if we're all alive in 20 years' time, and think, you know, I wouldn't say he's like Reagan. I think he's very different from Reagan. But there's something which is so different about him and defining that after you know sort of drift into global socialist you know world control, I wrote an article recently where I described all this as actually being very close to national socialism, and actually in that sense Donald Trump is a breath of fresh air.
Yes. All right.
But I mean I. You know, I wouldn't suggest he's really going to change anything hugely, but you know, let's just enjoy a little bit of rebellion.
Well, will he serve? Will he serve the full 4 years, Alistair?
I think he'll last the full 4 years.
I'll put you down.
He may even go on for the eight. I don't know.
Fair enough. All right. Question number two. Earlier today, Marine Le Pen was spotted at Trump Tower, and she is now. I saw a poll earlier this week says she's now the leading candidate for the presidency in France with an election coming up in about 4 or 5 months. So the question is, are we all going to get familiar with the term Frexit this year?
I love it. I love it. I mean, you know, this is the lovely thing about Donald Trump. Anyone else would say, I don't want to see that. I don't want to be associated with her. I don't want to know Nigel Farage. I mean, you know, no, but Donald Trump, he doesn't give a damn. Yeah. I think, isn't it wonderful?
Yeah.
So, we have Marine Le Pen. I mean, she's got to be elected by the French, unfortunately. and the French system actually makes it quite hard for her to become president. But there's no doubt about it. She's got a lot of a big move behind her. The French establishment, I think, will fight tooth and nail to stop her getting in, firstly. And secondly, even if she got in, they'd fight tooth and nail to keep the European project alive. So we're a long way from saying that Frexit, if you like, is anywhere near the cards. I think probably what we'd like to see, rather than Frexit, is a disintegration of the European Union.
Yeah. Well, there you go. We'll see. Like you said, they'll make it difficult for her to be elected, but you know they made it pretty difficult for Trump to be elected too. So we shall see.
They did.
Number three. Yeah,
go on.
I'm sorry.
Go on. I'm listening.
All right. Number three. Have you actually received any checks from the Russians for your appearances on Max Kaiser or RT?
Oh, gosh, I was hoping you wouldn't raise that subject.
I won't tell you.
Alas, no. Actually, I haven't been on Max Kaiser for some time, so perhaps they don't like me anymore. I don't know.
I got my check last year, and it bounced, and I, you know, no, I'm kidding. All right, just wanted to know if you were one of these agents that they say, you know, out there in the fake news world. So I didn't know if you were.
Well, I just want, you know, I mean, I'd even settle for a hotel bedroom in a posh hotel in Prague, but you know.
That hadn't happened either, huh? All right.
No, that hasn't happened either. No, we can dream.
The last question is, and this was Yorubuta's question, and I decided I'd sub it in number four. For your afternoon tea, is it one lump or two?
No sugar and no milk.
Just straight up tea, huh?
Straight up tea, yeah.
So when you order that, I mean, like coffee, when you order coffee and they say, and you just say, I want it black. When you order tea that way, do you say, I want it brown?
No, just no milk.
Oh, okay.
No, I mean, they obviously don't, you know, they put a sugar bowl there. To be honest, I tend to drink green tea rather than black tea. So
a slice of lemon. A slice of lemon, perhaps, Alistair?
Not really. No. Sometimes green tea comes already sort of pre-lemoned, and I try and avoid that.
Course.
It's rather like people have a habit of, you know, in hotels, they'll give you a jug of water and they put lemons in it. You know, I just want water. Really. Yeah. I tell you what, if I'm going to have a quick whiskey, I certainly don't want lemon in the whiskey either.
Well, all right, my friend. Again, Alistair McLeod, head of research at Gold Money. We're a big supporter of Gold Money. Love everything about them. Good friends there, from Mr. Turk to John Butler and obviously Alistair. Alistair, just take a second and tell everybody about Gold Money and where to go to find out more information.
Well, goldmoney.com, we got three products. We got what we call personal, which is, you know, straightforward account where you can preload a card with your currency. We've got business, so you can run your business being paid and paying out in gold. And we've also got the wealth side, which basically is the old Gold Money from Jersey, which was the business that James Turk set up. We're growing nice and rapidly, and I'm just so happy to be involved with what to me is the most exciting thing I have ever seen in financial technology. And my mission in life really is to persuade everybody about the merits of sound money and the demerits of unsound money. And sound money is obviously gold. And so for me, this is just an absolute dream. I think it's an amazing product. And I think we're going to take this all the way around the world. We've got customers in virtually every country around the world, and I think that this has got an enormous future, and I'm really very excited to extend this to just ordinary people who otherwise would be screwed by their governments.
Right, but they save in the fiat currency, which the governments are constantly devaluing and basically stealing and devaluing your savings. So I'm with you, my friend. Goldmoney.com, great company run by great people. I encourage everybody to check it out and consider opening an account. Alistair, thank you so much for your time. This is just always so extraordinarily valuable to talk with you. And I'm sure we'll visit again soon, but for now, I'll give you the rest of the day off.
Well, it's been very much my pleasure. I enjoy talking to the Turdites in Turdville very much indeed. And thank you for the invitation.
All right, my friend. Thanks again. And thanks for everybody for listening. We'll talk to you next week.